always. But before we get to the roll call, I'd like to give Dr. Melnick an opportunity to introduce our newest member, Dr. Sarah Garber. Alan, take it away.
So I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Garber. She is the official Peace Health Southwest Medical Center representative to FAC. And I'll say a few words, hopefully not embarrass her too much here. But so Dr. Garber is the new chief medical officer for Peace Health Southwest Medical Center. So, excuse me, replacing, I mean, I think you all remember Lawrence Neville, Dr. Neville, when he was on FAC. Dr. Garber is now the chief medical officer for Peace Health Southwest. She's really, I'll just give a few words as to why she's an exceptional candidate for the FAC position. So she's got a little bit of her background, combined Bachelor of Arts and Doctor of Medicine, combined degree from the University of Missouri. She's a graduate of the Mayo Clinic Graduate School of Biomedical Sciences, anesthesiology resident, where she was chief resident. She's also done an internal medicine internship. And also, in addition, I hope I'm getting this all right, Dr. Garber, correct me if I'm wrong, but she's also got an executive Master of Business Administration degree from the University of Washington. So she's got really well-rounded in terms of her leadership and her knowledge of systems, and that was from the University of Washington Foster School of Business. And she's also board certified in anesthesiology, and practicing anesthesiology in Washington since 2008, and she's been a partner with U.S. Anesthesia Partners in Seattle, Washington. Served as medical director of Anesthesia Services Swedish Medical Center from 2016 to 2018, and chief of staff elect from 2018 to 2019, and has been chief medical officer at Swedish Ballard Campus prior to coming here. The reason I'm saying all this is that she's been in a number of leadership positions and in terms of her training has leadership background in healthcare and medicine. So sorry for all that, but just want to introduce her and welcome Dr. Garber to the Public Health Advisory Council. I don't know if you want to say a few words.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Melnick, for the introduction. And firstly, thank you, lovely folks, for inviting me and allowing me to join this great group. I've had some interactions with Dr. Melnick on the Southwest Board, and in my almost 4 months here at Southwest, multiple interactions with him and the county health department. And I really, really appreciate the work that is going on in Clark County in the greater southwestern Washington area. And I really am excited and to join this group. So with that, I will stop talking because I do know we have quite a few things on the agenda, but I'm very grateful to join this group. Thank you, Dr. Melnick.
Thanks, Dr. Garber. We're so happy to have you here and welcome to FAC. Okay, let's go ahead and start the roll call. So you'd just like to verify who's at the meeting and make sure we have a quorum. So I'm going to go ahead and call your name and just please indicate if you are present. So we'll start with Elma Bloom.
Here.
Karen Bowerman.
Here.
John Brooks.
I'm here.
Sandra Brown. Oh, I know Sandy's not here today. Shauna Carter.
Shauna, here.
Peggy Carlson. Paul Childers.
Here.
Tyler Clary. Mark Collier. Heather Decker.
Here.
Remy Youson. Adrienne Fairbanks.
Present.
Dave Fuller.
Here. Remy's here.
Okay, Remy's here. Thank you.
Sorry.
Dave Fuller. Sarah Garber.
Here.
Amy Gross.
Here.
Alan Melnick.
I think you heard me, so I'm here, yes.
Stephanie Royce Yamashita.
Here.
Marla Sanger.
Here.
Andy Santos.
Present.
Cassandra Sellers-Reck. Michelle Stickley.
Here.
Maria Swingerinsky.
Present.
And I'm here too. And I know we have our public health staff here, including, of course, Dr. Melnick and Mallory and Brian and Andrea. So thank you everyone for being here. I just wanted to acknowledge Stephanie Royce Yamashita, who just texted us that this is her last meeting with FAC. Stephanie, we'll miss you. Thank you for being a part of FAC. Mallory, do we have a quorum? So I didn't get that.
Maybe she can put it in the chat.
Was anyone else keeping track?
How many are needed for the quorum?
Hey, I'm here.
We have a total of 21.
We do have a quorum.
11. I believe we need 11.
Mallory said we do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, she put it in the chat. Yep.
And then do we have any guests at our meeting today? And if so, can you please state your name and if you're representing any particular organization? All right. So let's go ahead to the formal approval of previous meeting notes. Can someone please give me a motion to approve the notes and just please state your name as well?
Motion, Maria Swingerinsky.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And anyone opposed, and please state your name so we have a count. Okay. Meeting notes from June are approved. I'm just going to quickly read through the agenda topics for today, and then we can get started. Sorry, let me just pull that up here. Sorry, I'm having trouble with my computer. Sorry, I apologize. I am trying to find this in my email, which conveniently decided to freeze, but okay, here we go. I have it. So we're gonna start with update on nominations and recruitment for vacant positions on FAC. And then there's a COVID update, monkeypox update, budget update, including talking about the budget 101 series, the budget subcommittee, public health fees, quick update on foundational public health recruitment and our strategic planning, and also a free fridge update. And we'll also talk about selecting a nominations committee or asking for volunteers for a nominations committee for a slate of officers for 2023. And then before we get started, is there anyone I don't believe we have any guests, but anyone who is here who wants to provide public comment, please state your name so we have a count. Okay. All right. Well, let's get to the meeting then, the heart of the meeting. So let's go ahead and start with an update on nominations and recruitment for vacant positions. And Dr. Melnick is presenting.
I'll be really brief about this. We have a new vacant position, which just want to let you all know. So Cassandra Cassie-Seledrick, she's no longer the Kalisindia Tribe representative, so we will be reaching out to the Cowlitz Indian Tribe for a new representative, and we'll keep you all posted. And once Dr. Garber was appointed, there are currently we're full without any vacancies, although we have some terms coming to an end. I don't have the list with me. I don't know if Lydia or Mallory have it. I'm happy to go get it and read it on through, but we will be doing some recruitments this fall.
BMW, so I probably have to extend.
You're not speaking, could everyone just make sure to mute their microphone, please?
I think whoever's in charge of the meeting can mute everyone.
I don't have control. I'm not the host of the meeting.
I think that would be Lydia or Mallory. So I'm not either. I can't do it either. I just tried.
Dr. Melnick, did you want to give us a COVID and monkeypox update as well?
Yeah, I can either do the PowerPoint, but maybe shorter than that. Maybe I'll do it briefer because we've got. So I'll just give you some highlights. I'll look at my PowerPoint and just give you some highlights in terms of the numbers. And you can all tune into the Board of Health meeting tomorrow when I'll be giving a more a bit more extensive update. So just so you all know, the numbers are going down both statewide and in Clark County. I'm talking about COVID-19 first before I get to monkeypox. And the 7-day case rate right now statewide is 140.5 per 100,000. And, you know, you want it to be below 200 to get down into the lower levels of, you know, community activity as defined by CDC. And the hospitalization rate has also gone down a bit to 8.2. So it's gone down a bit, but it's still, it's kind of slowly declining and kind of almost plateauing. In terms of Clark County, our 7-day case rate is now at 91.5 per 100,000 people. In May, at the peak in May, it was at 232. You know, and all these numbers in terms of rates are an undercount because a lot of people are doing over-the-counter testing, and if they test positive, the majority folks are not reporting it. So you can multiply these numbers that I'm giving you by several times, perhaps up to five times, to get a better idea what's out there. But compared to what we were in May, you know, we're significantly down. But it's kind of, if I showed you the graph, it's kind of a slow decline. In terms of the hospitalization rate, here in Clark County, the most recent numbers were at 9.2 per 100,000 over 7 days. You want it to be below 10. So that's good, but we still have 11% of hospital beds being occupied by COVID-19 patients, and you'd like that number to be below 10. So that really hasn't dropped significantly. And actually, in terms of the 9.2 rate, that's per 100,000 over 7 days, that's actually been a slight increase recently. The predominant variant is Omicron, and you know, one of the issues that we're seeing is that the Omicron sublineage BA5 is now in the United States is now accounting for 89% of cases. So it's a more transmissible variant. It's not any more severe than it's a sublineage. It is Omicron, but it's not any more severe than previous versions of it. But it is more transmissible, and it does have some ability to escape immunity from either previous infection or vaccination. So another reason for people to get their boosters. In Washington State, the latest week that we have data, Omicron BA5, the same sublineage, accounted for 84% of cases. So it's the majority of cases in the state. The rates, I'm not going to read you the numbers. I'll give you an overview, but all I can say is that the vaccines are effective. They are effective in preventing transmission, regardless of what you hear in social media sites and elsewhere. So in terms of, across different ages, the rate of cases in people who are unvaccinated compared to people who've just had their initial series is 1.6 to 2.1 times greater. The rate of hospitalization is anywhere from 3.2 to 4.1 times higher, and people over 65 are 3.1 times more likely to die if they're unvaccinated compared to people who are vaccinated. Unfortunately, the vaccination rates are still lagging. They're 69% of eligible people statewide. Well, actually, let me do the county one. I want to save time here. Anybody 6 months of age and older is eligible for the vaccine. And we have about 63% of that population is vaccinated, has received the initial series, I should say. So that means more than a third of folks have not even received the initial primary vaccine series. And then for those who are eligible to be boosted, and that's everybody five and older, only 56% of folks, excuse me, 56% of that population has received a booster. So one of my concerns for the fall, as kids are coming back into school, and the numbers are even lower in younger ages. For example, only 22% of children 5 to 11 have received a booster. So we're coming back into fall with a highly unvaccinated population, a very transmissible sublineage. And those are the concerns I have, and a transmissible version of the virus that is more able to evade protection from previous infection or vaccination. Okay, so here I am, gloom and doom. Next up is the monkeypox. I'll be quick. Just for those of you who are not familiar with it, it's a member of the orthopox virus family. Another member of that family is smallpox. Chickenpox is not a member of that family. It's a zoster virus. It's a totally unrelated virus. It causes pox-like lesions, but it's not in the same virus group. It's totally different. But monkeypox and smallpox are in the same family. The case numbers are rising, and I'll give you some numbers quickly, but it's not the risk to the public remains low. It's spread through really close contact. That means direct and kind of similar to smallpox, that it can be spread with direct contact with rash or scabs or lesions, you know, the pox-like lesions that infected people have. And also contact with bedding or clothing or objects that have been contaminated by body fluids or sores of an infected person. By the way, this is smallpox was the first use of, I think, bioterrorism here when when smallpox laden blankets were given to the indigenous population here, wiped out large, I mean, smallpox has a very high mortality rate, wiped out large numbers of people. So anyway, it can be transmitted that, monkeypox can be transmitted that way. And it also can be transmitted like smallpox through respiratory droplets. It's with monkeypox, it's not very contagious that way. You really need to be within 6 feet of somebody who's a case for 3 hours or more. So it's not contagious that way like COVID-19 is. And we have information on our website about this. You can go to a public health website and look for monkeypox, Clark County Public Health, clark.wa.gov, go to public health, and you can find our monkeypox page. I'm not going to go into the symptoms unless you want to hear more about it. I just want to give you the number of cases. And fortunately, the mortality rate, we haven't seen mortality here in the U.S. The version that we have is a Western African version that is less lethal, I think, than the Central African clade. But we've had more than 374 cases of monkeypox now in 14 counties in the state of Washington, 7 in Clark County, 6 are confirmed, 1 probable, but there isn't any other orthopox going around. So I assume that 1 probable will probably be monkeypox. So we could say 7 cases here. The first case was July 25th. And we're doing case when we, just like we do for other communicable diseases, we're doing case in contact investigation, and we identify close contacts. And hopefully in time, we recommend the vaccine, which I'll talk to about in a minute. Actually, I'll get into it right now. The vaccine is basically the same, based on the same strain of virus that's used for smallpox vaccine. And it's a vaccinia virus. I don't know if I pronounce it right. The Jynneos vaccine that we're using cannot replicate. It's a safe vaccine and needs to be given within 4 days of exposure and can prevent infection. It's a safe vaccine. We're working with our healthcare providers. There's a limited amount of vaccine available. We're working with our healthcare providers in terms of allocating the vaccine based on our healthcare partners' potential volume in terms of the populations that they see in their clinics and their sites, and their willingness to provide a vaccine to non-panel and uninsured patients. It's a two-dose vaccine that's given 8 days apart. To maximize the amount of vaccine right now, we're using a one-dose strategy because the incubation period, the time from exposure to becoming a case, ranges from 5 to 21 days. So that one dose can prevent you from becoming a case if you received it within the 4 days of exposure. And we want to maximize the amount of vaccine that's out there. So we have a one-dose strategy, with the exception for people who are moderately or severely immunocompromised. Right now, we start off giving the vaccine to close contacts of cases, of confirmed cases. We're also, we're trying to nip it in the bud. So we're trying to provide vaccine to cases to people who are considered at a higher risk of exposure. And that will include, I'll read it off to you, it's the state guidelines, but gay, bisexual, or other person born male who's had sexual contact with another person born male, trans or non-cisgender people who've had sex with people who identify as gay, bisexual, otherwise men who have sex with men, and who in the past 3 months have had multiple or anonymous partners, exchange sex for money, drugs, or other purposes, used meth, had been in attendance at a bathhouse, public sex venue, or group sex, history of early syphilis or gonorrhea, and experiencing homelessness and or incarceration. We're really working to try to protect this population as much as possible. You understand that the disease can be transmitted. It's not a sexually transmitted disease, but the populations we're seeing have had, for example, close contact, including anonymous contact, and that puts them at more at risk, and we really want to protect that population. So that's where we're trying to use the vaccine right now. And there is an antiviral treatment, and it's really for people who are more likely to get severely ill, particularly people who get monkeypox who have moderate severe immunocompromise. So that's kind of the update on, and I'm sorry for going so quickly on that. I'll be talking to the Board of Health about this tomorrow as well. I don't know if anybody has any questions. Looks like Peggy has a question. See if you speak to me.
For people who've had the smallpox vaccine years and years and years ago, does that offer any kind of protection?
It certainly does. And I'm not sure how long the, I was one of the fortunate, I was vaccinated as a child because I'm old enough to be that. And then after 9/11, I was working as a health officer and we were concerned about bioterrorism, if you remember those days. So I got another dose of smallpox vaccine. It's based on the same vaccinia virus. I'm not sure exactly how long that protection lasts. So I think, and I'm going to have to look this one up, I think if you're exposed to monkeypox, and even if you fit in the categories that I'm talking about right now, I'd recommend the vaccine if you're, close contact. Great question. And I'm going to double check that one and be prepared for the Board of Health tomorrow as well.
Alan, question about COVID, and I'm sorry if I missed this. Is BA4, BA5 still the dominant strain? And I've heard on the news that we might have boosters, maybe as early as September.
So that's a great question. And right now, BA5 nationally, actually statewide, BA5 is at 84%. And BA4 is at 12.9%. So the majority are, BA5. And I believe the vaccine manufacturers are working on vaccines that have more effectiveness in terms of these Omicron and I believe these sublineages as well. I'm not sure exactly when they'll be available. Perhaps in September, but I don't have any more information than that. Good question. Anything else? You're all still awake, although I can't tell because those who have their video on are still awake, so...
Well, thank you, Dr. Melnick, for that.
One other last thing, and I'm sorry, Aru. I would also encourage people, if you haven't gotten your flu vaccine before, get a flu vaccine this year when they become available as well, because, we're very likely to have and I probably should mention this at the Board of Health tomorrow, I don't think COVID is going away anytime soon, given what I've told you and the low vaccination rate in the population. But, we don't want to see a whole lot of respiratory illness. And I'm also, like I said, we haven't had a flu season for the last two years at least. So that there's more susceptibility in the population there. And people are being, tired of the masking and all that other stuff and less likely to practice those behaviors. So really urge people to not only make sure you get your booster doses for COVID-19, but you get the flu vaccine as well. You can get them at the same time. So I did that last year. So anyway, okay, now I'll shut up.
Thank you, Dr. Melnick. Any other questions for Dr. Melnick before we move on to our budget update from Jeff? All right, Jeff, take it away.
Well, Alan mentioned people still being awake. I will quickly take care of that. We are on to a budget update. So in prior years, you know, we would review our budget and our environmental public health fee scenario proposals with FAC, but it was always at a very summary level. You know, as we discussed in prior FAC meetings with the adoption of House Bill 1152, it's placed FAC into a formal advisory role with our annual budget process. This past year, this past spring, we were working on our 2023 budget, and we did our best to adapt on the fly and engage FAC during the process, but it was clear we were not able to provide sufficient granularity to allow FAC to provide any real good feedback, and it's our fault just due to the time constraints. We will be launching a Budget 101 series starting with the next FAC meeting with the intent of really bringing FAC information on the budget process in Clark County, both at the county level as well as our internal department budget process. I envision that taking 30 to 45 minutes for a couple meetings, and it'll give some information, but it'll still be fairly high level. We're also looking at proposing a budget subcommittee, even with a Budget 101 information series, to really have enough in-depth knowledge of the public health budget to provide substantive and meaningful feedback on the budget. It's really going to require additional concentrated engagement. The budget process itself is far too compressed to contain the level of engagement we would need into a monthly two-hour meeting. I had proposed a few budget retreats throughout our budget process in the spring, and it just doesn't seem realistic for the entirety of FAC to be able to attend a few multiple-hour meetings. So what we're proposing, again, is a budget subcommittee for members who have the bandwidth to dedicate the time necessary to become more intimately familiar with the public health budget. And if FAC is agreeable, we would not need to identify the subcommittee tonight. We can complete the Budget 101 series and then fill out the subcommittee then if that's what FAC would like to do. So I'll pause there on the Budget 101 and the budget subcommittee proposal to see if there are any questions.
I just reinforce something there, Jeff. I mean, it would really help us, you know, and the advantage of FAC is that it brings in community stakeholders and community input. It'll be really helpful to have, you know, have this subcommittee and get input. And as part of the new statutory role of FAC as well. So.
All right. Well, you can all look forward to a gripping Budget 101, which will launch next meeting. So.
Got a question there, Jeff.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, I see a question from Peggy, it looks like.
Peggy's got a question. Thanks, Jeff. How many people are you imagining would need to make up the budget committee? And what do you anticipate the time commitment to be?
Excellent questions. I wouldn't want to limit the size of the subcommittee if there are enough. I mean, whoever on FAC has the time to dedicate to the engagement, I'm comfortable with. I haven't talked to our leadership team about the size of the subcommittee, but again, I don't have a preconceived notion as to a number. I'd welcome as many FAC members as had the time to commit. The time commitment itself, boy, I am envisioning a couple 4-hour meetings. We don't usually have budget meetings longer than that. And I have not talked this over with Dr. Melnick, but I'm thinking if it's not a very large subcommittee, we could actually have the subcommittee meet with our leadership team at some of our regularly scheduled budget meetings to observe and ask questions. It might need to be a separate retreat, depending on the size of the committee. Excellent questions.
But once you learn about the local government budgeting process, it gets easier over time. Is that true, Jeff, or?
I've been here 24 years. I'm just learning some of the, no, yes, it definitely gets easier. Having the understanding of the framework and the process will definitely help, yeah.
And this, you know, provides more transparency for us in the community as well with FAC being involved.
100% agree, yep, completely. Any other questions on the Budget 101 series or the Budget Subcommittee proposal?
Jeff, quick question. Do you envision this subcommittee meeting throughout the year, or is it like a certain number of months where it's budget season and you're meeting and then, you know, hopefully you're done with the budget?
Yeah, another excellent question. I envision the subcommittee meeting early spring and being complete probably early July. The budget this year was due in early August, and that means I need about a month to compile everything from the budget and have it line up with the county budget process, and that also includes having one-on-ones and work sessions regarding our environmental public health and our medical examiner fees with the Board of Health and the County Council. So we can't finish the budget at the end of July and give me a week or two to get everything compiled and entered into the budget system. So really, by early July, we need to have our budget complete, our budget work complete. So I'm thinking late winter, early spring through early July. Marla's got a question.
I'm wondering if the Budget 101 sessions will be held via Zoom, and likewise the subcommittee, will that be via Zoom?
So the Budget 101 will be during our regularly scheduled FAC meetings.
Okay.
So as long as our regularly scheduled FAC meetings are via Zoom, that's where that'll occur.
Right.
The budget subcommittee meetings, I can't look that far out in the future to know. We might be back in the office. If we are back in the office, I'm sure we would have a remote or a hybrid feature available. I guarantee it.
Great. Thank you.
The other way we envision this is that, you know, the role of FAC as a Community Health Advisory Board is to provide advice to the Board of Health and the County Council. So this would be really helpful for our County Council as well, for FAC members to take a deep look at this and provide input to them as well. I see Council Chair Bowerman nodding her head, so.
All right, one more. Oh, I think you're on mute, Counselor.
Still muted.
Sorry about that. I was just going to say that being familiar with this budget process really opens up your ability to look at all of the budgets, because the process is virtually the same in all of the departments. Just the content obviously differs. And so I think it would be so valuable of a thing to have learned and to have that behind you. Thank you for doing it, and I really recommend it to everybody. I wish I'd had that when I started as a counselor. Seriously. It's kind of assumed that you're born knowing this, and you don't know the process just automatically. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you. Any other questions? One more shot. Any other questions? All right. The next topic on the budget agenda item is our fees. So environmental public health fees, we completed our work session with the Board of Health on July 6th. They gave us support for adjusting fees consistent with Board of Health policy, current Board of Health policy. We'll be bringing forward an ordinance at our October Board of Health. Until then, that support is merely support to bring forward the ordinance. Again, it's to continue with our existing policy on cost recovery, which is 90% cost recovery in our on-site septic permitting and drinking water programs, and 100% cost recovery everywhere else in environmental public health. We also completed a work session with the County Council on August 3rd, where the council entertained and was supportive of us bringing forward an ordinance enacting a new fee structure for the medical examiner's office. And again, it's just support to bring forward the ordinance until the ordinance is actually formally approved. it's just support to bring forward the ordinance. Clark County, we're the only medical examiner office with no fee structure. So through 2022, MEO services were supported primarily, but not exclusively, by the general fund. This will bring in additional user fee revenue. The new fee structure will also allow us to add an additional death investigator position and convert both a project autopsy technician position and a project office assistant position to permanent positions. So we were, it was a great process, learning process for me, working with Andrea Pruitt on our leadership team and developing both the proposal and the presentation. Andrea did a tremendous job with the council, and we're looking forward to being able to provide the resources to the medical examiner's office to give them sufficient staffing. So are there any questions on the environmental public health fees or the medical examiner's office fees?
I just wanted to add one other thing. I don't know whether Andrea wants to jump in. One of the reasons we're looking at, we've been looking at increasing staffing in the medical examiner's office, is that not only have the number of deaths gone up over the last several years, but the death rate has gone up as well. And so the workload, and including deaths that are medical examiner deaths. So that's why we got here. Andrea, I don't know whether you want to add anything to that or not.
I'm trying to think. Do folks have any questions about the role of the medical examiner's office in the county? That might be just a quick place to start. So primarily, the office is responsible for determining cause and manner of death for jurisdictional deaths for where we assume responsibility. So anything that's considered to be unnatural in terms of manner and death is typically our jurisdiction. And so we have a team of death investigators who work with our chief medical examiner, who is a forensic pathologist, to determine cause and manner. So it's a small group. They run service operations around the clock, 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and work with allied professionals and law enforcement and fire and EMS to be a part of that death industry and that infrastructure to ensure that all community members have access to a timely determination for cause and manner as a process of unnatural circumstances. So homicide, suicide, undetermined, and accidental deaths. So that's the work they do. And then, yes, we've seen a sharp rise in our death rates relative to the population growth. And so definitely need some additional staff to support with managing that increased rate relative to the historical staffing levels we've been able to maintain.
That includes things like opioid overdoses or, okay.
And so that would typically fall under the umbrella of an accidental death, unless there's very specific evidence and data to support that it was intentional. But so the three primary driving categories of accidental death are overdoses to drug consumption and motor vehicle or traffic related accidents, and then falls and fractures. Those are the three big categories. That's a great question. And so we're working with a number of partners to analyze data related to overdose fatalities. We've developed a dashboard, so we're going to preview that for a leadership team. And if this group would have interest in taking a look at that, we could organize the presentation from some of our epidemiologists to show that to you as well.
That's our opioid dashboard, correct?
Yeah, that is correct. And so it uses syndromic surveillance and emergency department admissions, deaths. We analyze samples collected through the tox lab, through WSP at the state, and all sorts of different inputs to track what drugs are circulating in the community, what type of impacts they have on morbidity and mortality, and what public health strategies and measures we can use to reduce the impacts of those deaths. So very, very big key piece of the violence and injury prevention services arm of public health.
Excellent. Thank you, Andrea. Well, if there's no other questions on the budget, my last piece of advice next month is to not eat a carb-heavy meal ahead of FAC, because if you are sleepy going into it, I might finish you off. So, thank you all.
So we should nap first?
I would be rested.
No late lunches?
Yeah.
Okay. Jeff, are you doing the foundational public health services update?
It was not on my agenda to do so. However, I can speak to the positions, the foundational public health services positions under my portfolio.
So, Jeff, maybe I'll start it off, and then I'll have people participate, if that's okay.
Sure.
Hedrick. So, we, as you may all know, the legislature has allocated money for foundational public health services, and I think the total is up to about $5 million a year in Clark County. I see Jeff nodding his head. So, we've been... and there's a number of different areas that are considered foundational public health services. I think we shared this with you before, but they include and are not limited to things like communicable disease control, life course, and Andrea may talk a little bit more about that when we get to her, environmental public health. And there's also capabilities like assessment and business competencies. I may have left a couple of out, but these are all services that are necessary to protect and promote the health of our population. And it's been underfunded for years. The legislature allocated the money. We brought the staff report to our Board of Health and our County Council, and it's been approved. So we're in the process of recruiting and hiring a number of folks. And I'll start off with my piece. We're hiring another deputy health officer and a deputy department director as well. Kind of be the deputy health officer. Our TB caseload is up. There's a lot of things we're not getting to around communicable disease, for example, that we, and in environmental health, that we could use health officer time. We're also covering several counties through agreements with them. So we're hiring another deputy health officer. And then the deputy director will actually help with serve as kind of like a chief operations officer, but take a lead in shepherding us through our strategic planning process, our racial equity work, and also helping liaison with other county departments, including, for example, human resources and facilities. So I don't want to go on too long, but each of us in our different portfolio has some areas where we're adding staffing through FVHS. Jeff, go ahead and you can talk about administrative services, and maybe Andrea can talk about healthy communities, and Brian can talk about environmental public health, and one of us can talk about what we're doing in communicable disease control. We'll be brief too, so we can go on for really put people to sleep again. So
I'll go real quick. We've got five positions in admin services, business services that we've added. One accounts payable accounting assistant three. I'm sorry, office assistant three, as well as a management analyst who will be focused on financial reporting. And then we've got a new program, basically, that is going to be a program manager one, a program coordinator, and a program assistant that will be responsible for our performance management, quality improvement, as well as the centralization of some administrative functions that we had decentralized many years ago during budget difficulties.
Andrea, do you want to, they are, okay.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. I can give it just a high-level update. We are staffing 6.5 FTEs worth of new positions, and then we had another 0.5 FTE that was added on to some existing positions. So the life course proposal that was funded and approved by the committee at the state level is inclusive of parenting and pregnant teen families, maternal child health, chronic disease, violence and injury prevention, and access to care. So the positions that we'll be onboarding will be working with those within those domains to move upstream towards primary prevention measures in the community to improve the health and well-being of all folks who are living here. And we also are hiring a child death review coordinator. So that's incredibly important in terms of prevention work to inform and have a multidisciplinary community level review of any unnatural deaths that take place with children ages birth to 18. So that's really, really important that we do that work. And it's been historically an unfunded mandate at the state. So that was a pretty big win for us. We're also going to be hiring a senior policy analyst, a strategic initiatives coordinator, health planner, an urban regional planner. So we'll be able to partner with updates on our comp plan. So really hoping for some additional capacity to do more and deeper work in the communities is a very big deal for this department. So I'm excited about it.
Great summary. Thanks, Andrea. And we'll have, and by the way, if there are questions when we get through this, we're happy to answer them. Go for it, Brian.
Hey, everyone. So environmental health, we have five FTE that are they're soon to be hired using FPHS. Two of those, well, our programs have grown significantly over the last couple of years, and so we're hiring two program coordinators to help support our managers and just day-to-day work. And one of the exciting things that these program coordinators will do will be looking for grant opportunities to support our existing work. A very exciting piece of FPHS is we've created a new program in environmental public health called Environmental Outreach, Science, and Policy, which that's a broad brush of things that can be involved. But so we're recruiting right now for a program manager. As soon as we fill that, we'll be hiring for an environmental epidemiologist, which is a new role within EPH, as well as an environmental health specialist that'll focus on zoonotic and vector-borne not diseases, but just kind of pest management, working with schools and restaurants to make sure that they're maintaining pests appropriately. And we do get a surprising number of complaints about bed bugs and just questions from the community, you know, what are certain insects and should they be worried? And so we'll build out our support for that. And this program will also have a health educator that's currently funded by FPHS, the first round FPHS, and that will move to the new program. So these programs will we give general support for all of our EPH programs in increased education and outreach, collaboration with Andrea's folks to share data and inform the work we do. And our EPI will, what I'm really excited about is work with existing data and data sets to create some geospatial mapping with our GIS department to just understand the framework, the things that are happening in our community, with different mapping capabilities, and that will be used to inform our work, current work, and future work moving forward. So, yeah, very exciting.
So, Roxanne isn't here, so I'll go and talk about our investigation response. We'll be hiring several positions, three positions in infection prevention. And that's been a real issue. There are a number of, for example, healthcare-associated infections that can travel from facility to facility, like C. difficile, and we're seeing a lot more, we're beginning to see a lot more MDRO, multiple drug-resistant organisms. We're doing an investigation right now. That's become an ongoing problem. Which actually one of the things I hope we can do is develop an antibiotic stewardship program to see if we can reduce the amount of unnecessary antibiotics that are used, because that leads to resistant organisms. So those are some of the things we might be working on there as well. Increasing our capacity in terms of communicable disease control. I think the pandemic highlighted, you know, deficiencies there as well. And then our emergency response, I didn't mention that, that's another FPHS service, a public health emergency response and preparedness will be beefing up our capacity there as well, hopefully to deal, be better prepared to deal
hopefully we won't have another pandemic, but be better prepared to deal with that right at the beginning. So that's where we're moving there. I don't know if folks have any questions.
I have a question, but I don't know where it fits. So here it comes anyway. We are seeing in the news, all kinds of news, pictures of fentanyl that look like candy. Is that becoming an issue in Clark County? And maybe Dr. Garber knows directly from having seen patients in this regard, but I haven't heard about it here. What's happening?
Andrew, do you want to answer that, or the bottom line is that fentanyl has been a increasing issue and an increasing problem. It's multiple times more potent than heroin and morphine. Actually, people are smoking it as well and overdosing that way as well as injecting it. But it comes in a variety of. I've seen rainbow fentanyl and heard about that. Andrea, I don't know what we've seen, and maybe Dr. Garber has some more information about that, but it's a huge problem.
Dr. Garber, if you'd like to share your experience, then I could follow up with anything
Sure.
that you don't cover.
Yeah, the sort of the experience on the patient using side is we have seen a significant uptick of it, both for patients in the emergency department, but also for our folks that would traditionally be using other types of opioids, we've seen a significant shift to fentanyl. And fentanyl is also for physicians something that's new and difficult to manage because these patients are experiencing withdrawal and experiencing symptoms in ways in which even our addiction treatment specialists have never seen before. So, and it's increasing. So yes, it's out there. Yes, we're seeing it more. And from the reports that I've heard, and I suspect Andrea may be able to speak more to it, is it is less expensive, and we're seeing it cut into additional other drugs that folks are buying. And so it's becoming more prolific, I guess is probably the right word, is we're seeing it in addition to other substances that folks are using.
Mm. And that's exactly right. So essentially what's happening, it's cheaper to make, it's cheaper to produce. You can produce it in larger quantities, and so it's outpacing the heroin market. So when you actually talk to folks who are using substances, it's not that it's necessarily the drug of choice, it's what's available. And in the event that you don't know what you're taking, or somebody gives you something and you think it's something else, and you don't have any tolerance built up, you're more likely to overdose if you had recently been incarcerated, or gone through, detox, and then you use a substance that may have fentanyl in it. You're also more likely to overdose, and so we're seeing. And I think the thing to always reground is there is no user profile for these substances, right? It's folks that are your neighbors and folks that you walk by on the street, And we need to figure out how to mobilize a response to support the community, our young folks, folks that are experimenting, right? Adolescent, college age kids, right? Getting a hold of something, thinking something pretty benign, going out, exploring for the first time, overdosing. So there are no, there's multiple experiences that we can apply and learn from, and they're working on legislation at the state to establish similar death reviews for exactly this this issue. And so then the next step again will be figuring out how to fund it. And so there's some exploratory groups across LHJs in the state that are figuring out, okay, what does that process look like, and how do we really use every available resource and all the data we're collecting to kind of push back against some of the distribution patterns that we're observing in the community.
The messaging, the simple messaging that, we need to get out there, and I think we have been, is that if you're not getting it from a prescription through a pharmacy, if you're getting some drugs some other way, there's a very reasonable likelihood that it contains fentanyl. So if you're getting it other than a, prescription, or from a pharmacy, you're at risk. And, we're talking about something, Dr. Garber, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but, you know, 50 times the potency of morphine, of heroin, 100 times the potency of morphine. I mean, we're talking about something that extremely deadly here, and cheap.
And they've made it now to look like those chunky M&Ms.
Oh, yeah. If you're not getting it, exactly. Well, this is really cheering everybody up here now.
It's important to understand what the risks are and to reflect into the communities we work in day to day to be able to stay ahead of, to the best of our abilities, the shifting environment and the spaces where fentanyl is landing. So I think we can provide kind of regular updates to the group on what we're observing in the community and this, you know.
It's being caught with everything. So people buying methamphetamine, for example, if you're buying methamphetamine, there's a good chance that it's got fentanyl with it. So, and it'll kill you. So people need to know that. And, you know, smoking it is, it's pretty lethal smoking it as well as injecting it. Marla's got a question.
Yes, this is pretty discouraging. I knew that it was becoming more available, but it sounds like it's just proliferating kind of out of control. And so is there any attempt we as a community, as communities, trying to keep pace with making available Narcan? I assume Narcan would be helpful for this. And so are we getting it into people's hands, everybody? I mean, because from what I'm hearing, we might not know that somebody that, like you say, a neighbor, somebody we love, and seeing the signs and symptoms that they might be in danger, Narcan probably wouldn't hurt them, but it could save them. So
yeah, if naloxone, which is a generic name for Narcan, if one of us took naloxone, it basically is completely safe. The only thing it is an opioid antagonist. So if you and I took some Narcan or naloxone right now, it wouldn't hurt us. If we were overdosing, it would certainly help us. Andrea, do you want to talk about what we're doing around naloxone and getting it out there?
Yes, absolutely. There's been some grants where we have been working with Swatch to place Narcan vending machines and distribute them across the community. We're also working on a research grant with some other local health jurisdictions right now to pilot a community project where community members can opt in to, it's essentially an app where you carry Narcan with you. And if you receive a ping and you're geolocated within a certain area, someone's experiencing an overdose, you can go and apply doses of Narcan until emergency medical services arrive. So, yeah, and so we train staff and folks that circulate in and around the community to have Narcan on hand and how to dispense it. So there's a number of different strategies, and that's one that is definitely one that we deploy and use regularly. And I think what I'm hoping and really interested in is how can we, you know, I think with the COVID pandemic and isolation, there's more community fracture. So moving more upstream towards prevention and health promotion, right? Connectedness and behaviors that encourage gathering and a sense of community are also really helpful. And so that's something that we're hoping to explore with some of our built environment initiatives and the comp plan. And there's some really innovative ways communities are structuring their physical built environment so folks aren't as isolated. So there's a number of different strategies that we're working on to that effect.
By the way, we've also been giving out naloxone for years in our harm reduction center. So, you know, also known as a student exchange. And Andrea, you can correct me if I'm wrong in this, because more people are smoking, less people are actually coming in for syringe exchange, yeah. I believe. So the other concern is, you know, people are now smoking fentanyl and smoking and getting overdosed that way, but they're not exchanging syringes anymore. That's why we have to think about other ways of, another way of getting naloxone out there into the community.
And I think with each strategy,
there are, you know, rate limiting steps and things that folks are working on. How often are you stocking your vending machines? Who has access to them? Are they made publicly available? Things like that. So, Amy, your hand up.
Is there a legitimate clinical use for fentanyl?
I can speak to that one as a practicing anesthesiologist. Fentanyl is the prime pain medication that's used in most anesthetics, and it's very, very good for short acting pain control. But for example, to Dr. Melnick's point, when we dose it in clinical doses for pain control, we dose it in micrograms. And in comparison, morphine, for example, is dosed in milligrams. So the sheer amount of opioid that is really highly concentrated is what makes it easier to manufacture in larger batches, easier to move around in larger batches, and more attractive to cut into things. So yes, used in a very appropriate clinical way for lots and lots of reasons, but very potent when used in outside of a healthcare setting.
Thank you.
I'm just wondering, and maybe Dr. Garber can speak to this, is there a legitimate use for like long-term pain control with fentanyl, or is it really just used for the short acting?
No, so the long-term pain control for fentanyl is most commonly seen in folks. Actually, I think it's FDA approved for long-term cancer pain. So folks that have intractable pain related to terminal diseases is a common prescribing place for fentanyl patches, for example. And that's the most common place you would see pain control in the long-term place for fentanyl. Fentanyl is not a common pill. You won't see it prescribed for sort of routine use. The couple of places you will see it is sort of acutely in a hospital setting for severe short-term pain, surgery, most commonly, and then for long-term end-of-life use with fentanyl patches.
Thank you. Other questions? Well, thank you for that very important, but I think very sobering update. And Andrea, did you want to speak to the strategic planning process, kind of just shifting gears a little here?
Yes, absolutely. I'll provide FAC with a very brief update. I'm happy to report that the RFP for the Strategic Plan, Community Health Assessment, and Community Health Improvement Plan processes goes live tomorrow. It closes on September 14th, and we're scheduled to begin work with the selected contractor on mid-October, so October 15th. And that process will be huge, so exciting. That process will last through March 2024, and so the primary areas of focus for this contractor will be to serve as a facilitator, to provide technical assistance, and steward the project management for these three work products in a really effective way to consider the three products working together as part of a broader system. As the strategic plan is really that reflection and assessment of where we are as an agency, what is our role and scope of work, public health practice in the community, and then the community health needs assessment as a reflection and a dialogue of what are the needs of our community and how do we make sure that we're aligning and stewarding joint collective resources to ensure the best improvement in health and social well-being impact. So really excited about that. So this group will have an opportunity to serve not only as stakeholders and providing input and feedback into your experiences and your day-to-day work and also your experience as a part of this group, but then also serving as that sounding board for the work products that we'll create that will ultimately serve as a roadmap to help us make decisions as a community. And I think that's something where we have a lot of opportunity for growth. I think there's a lot of good work happening in the community, but to the degree that we can leverage each other's work products to make them go farther in terms of resource allocations and staffing, I think the better off we'll be. Have a joint, shared, reflected community health-based mission. So, any questions on that?
We'll be coming back to FAC with this, correct? Yes.
Yes. FAC, along with the Board of Health, is one of the primary audience stakeholders outside of the community members. This work product ideally should reflect the experiences and needs of our communities. But this group will have a front row seat to critique their work products, provide input, serve as a strategic touch point for managing the direction and ensuring we're headed in the right direction, right? I think there's so many different places and spaces where we spend our time that impact health. So it's a pretty broad umbrella. So understanding what our role and scope is relative to our partners doing really key, related work will be important so we can make those distinctions.
We really want this to be as inclusive as possible and be a community process. We don't want to be insular about this at all.
There's no other comments or questions for Andrea. Thank you for that update. So I think we can move on to now talk about the free fridge update. I know we had a lot of really great discussion around this the last time we talked about this. So before I turn it over to Brian for an update, I actually wanted to share a little bit from an article that Council Chair Bowerman was kind enough to forward to me last month. And this is an article in the Oregonian about Portland's free fridge program and, you know, the benefits, but also some of the pitfalls that Portland has run into. So, please indulge me. I'm going to read you a couple of paragraphs from this article because I just think it is so fascinating. So indisputably, the fridges have done a whole lot of good, including this week when a heat wave prompted supporters to stock fridges with cold water and ice. But some of the fridges also have run into a very Portland problem. Residents earnestly want to help, then are confronted with eye-opening reality. Visitors who ring doorbells at night enter yards or use the structures and landscaping as toilets. Entire contents of fridges inexplicably dumped onto the pavement, rodents, knocked over fridges, cut electrical cords, and in some extreme cases, people in mental crisis who threaten to hurt the very neighbors who stock the fridges full of food. And there's a lot more in this article, and I'm not going to read you all of it, but really, I think this article really, to me, brought home, that this can be such a great service, right? But it also, we're confronting some harsh realities with a free fridge program. And I think it really brings to the forefront discussions around, the mental health crisis and, the role of law enforcement, role of public health, role of the community, of neighbors. And so I really liked, the very last sentence of the article was, one of the neighbors who does this saying, it sounds like a very easy thing, right? Plug in a fridge. I didn't put a fridge in my yard and think the job was done. It's not like Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come and everything will be dandy. You're dealing with some real issues. So I just wanted to share that article. And Peggy, thank you for that link to the article. I highly encourage you to read it. It is just, it was just fascinating. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Brian so he can give us an update on Clark County's free fridge program. I'd be happy to then have a discussion around this. I'm sure there's a lot of questions and thoughts and, you know, concerns, ideas.
We found that article very interesting as well. So that made its rounds through our department. Interesting anecdotal side pieces. During those 100-degree days that we had in Vancouver, all of our free fridges actually self-monitored and shut down because none of them can maintain temp. We don't know how long the food was kept in there at an unsafe temp. We don't know what happened to it, but once they did shut them down, they threw it away. So we don't have any monitoring system currently for these fridges, which is why we've convened the ethics board, and we're moving forward with an ethics deliberation. We're looking at the fourth week in September. We pushed out a little bit because getting community buy-in and stakeholders a part of this process is the most important piece. And so it's been slow going to get folks to sign on to it. But we have a growing list of about 45 folks from different DFDOs, from the Vancouver Free Fridge, different community groups, organizations, neighborhood organizations. So, and the list continues. And so if you have anyone that you think might be interested from an organization or neighborhood association or just somebody who feels strongly about it, I think we could reach out to me. We could talk about getting them added to this. we're also working on bringing a contractor on to help not facilitate, but just set up the breakout rooms and make sure everything's managed appropriately. But Alan will be facilitating the meeting is how we're moving forward. And Alan, I'll give you a second to share just your thoughts on that. But yeah, everything's running smoothly, and we are, I think, on schedule, an adjusted schedule, but on schedule.
So just to add on to that, I think I've mentioned public health ethics. I think Michelle's a member of our public health ethics committee, and maybe some other folks here as well, and you're welcome to join. But public health ethics is a little bit different than bioethics, which has to do with the provider-patient relationship. In public health ethics, we actually deal with issues that are kind of unique to public health. So one of the, you know, things like how do we allocate resources, you know, like ventilators or vaccines. And one of the other things that given the authority we have as public health, how do we deal with our statutory authority? I don't like the term, it's a police power that's it's reserved to the states, it's delegated to us. But, you know, the question that came up with these free fridges, because of our concerns about food safety and potential foodborne illness, should we be exerting our authority to basically restrict these operations? And that's how the issue came up. But there's other concerns as well. And when it's been helpful to me, been working in this field for a while, is to really build community trust. You know, we want to use the least restrictive means we can to have the community be safe. But in areas that have come up about, you know, individual rights versus a public health authority, getting a group of stakeholders together, identify all the stakeholders, and having them deliberate about this using a framework that we've developed in public health ethics, you know, looking, you know, identifying what the goals of what you're trying to, decision you're trying to make, of any intervention you do, what are the risks and harms and concerns, who are the stakeholders and what are their claims. Being able to deliberate about this hopefully will get us to a point where we can make a decision about what we need to do vis-a-vis this free fridge program and making it as safe as possible. So that's why it's a large group. There's a large group. I mean, we've done ethics deliberations before with much smaller groups, but given the number of stakeholders involved, and Brian mentioned some of them, we're looking at like around 50 people to participate. So we'll have to do, generally you have, you know, like 10 or 15 people and you convene to do this, but we're going to be doing breakout rooms and have multiple facilitators and going through the process. But I'm hoping at the end of the day, I don't think this has been done with a free fridge. These things have just been proliferating. But every time I've done a community process like this with the ethics committee, you kind of come up with ideas that you haven't thought of. And at the end of the day, the fact that people get their voices heard and get their perspectives heard, I think is really builds trust. And we want this to be as inclusive as possible. So we're planning this in the end of September, and you're all welcome to participate.
Thank you.
That's a mouthful right there. So,
So we have three fridges in Vancouver or in Clark County. CL King has 10 fridges. There's, I think, five in Tacoma Pierce. And as Alan said, nobody's doing is convening the community to discuss this. And so there's a lot of eyes on us from Seattle King, from the state. The State Department of Health would like to sit in, and if it's in a non-threatening way, they don't want.
They're going to participate. They're not just going to sit in. They may participate. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. That's not a conversation I've had with them yet. But so there's a lot of interest to see, you know, what happens with this and how we move forward.
And we want to get as many diverse perspectives on this, people with different life experiences to, you know, we're inviting the free fridge folks, the proponents of this, as well as people who may be opposed. But we want to get as much perspective on this as we possibly can.
Is there anyone from Portland joining the discussion, Alan?
We haven't reached out to them. You know, we have the free fridge advocates right here in Clark County. So I don't know that we need, to have people from Portland involved in. We have the proponents and opponents and neutral folks. I mean, we've got a variety of folks with different opinions about this. And we will have subject matter experts as well. So, you know, Brian and his staff, me to a certain extent in terms of, you know, like the issues around foodborne illness and stuff like that, questions come up. We also have, we have an ethicist on our committee. I think we just got a new one. He's a bioethicist from Legacy. And our county prosecuting attorney is involved because questions about legal authority always come up in terms of these things. Brian mentioned DFDOs, which are distributed food distribution organizations. I'm not getting the acronym correctly, but they have they have to follow a certain administrative code. So issues come up about our authority. So we'll have the attorney there as well, who's a member of our ethics committee, by the way. Should be interesting.
Will you be sending us all an invite?
We can go ahead, Brian. Were you going to say something, or
if that's what the group would like? Yeah, I can forward the invite to everyone. I guess I'd be curious. Is there enough folks interested in participating that I should send it to everyone, or? Says yes, please. Okay.
We're going to ask some members of our ethics committee. I know that certainly our internal staff, Michelle, if you're interested, to be facilitators on this, because we're going to have to go into breakout rooms and have different people take the different smaller groups through the process, because there's a framework that we use. It's kind of like a list of questions that you go through in three steps, and the number of questions with each, to make it kind of organized and facilitated. So we'll need people who have done that before who can help facilitate it. I've done it a gazillion times, so I'll be one of the facilitators. Well, and Brian, we're going to do a training for folks. Are you volunteering?
I've done facilitation before.
So yeah, I kind of volunteer myself.
That'll teach you. Okay. I don't know if there's anybody else on the ethics committee on this, on FAC right now. But you don't have to be a member of the ethics committee to participate. What we do is we have a core group of committee members that are made of both community partners, Michelle's an example, and staff who've been through the training. We're going to do another training again to refresh people. And then we have what are called ad hoc members, which are generally, depending on what you're deliberating, you want to bring in people who are interested and have a stake in that particular issue. So when we deliberated about whether vaping should be allowed in indoor places, this is many years ago in Clark County,
we actually involved member, we invited members of the vaping industry to come in and be part of the deliberation. So those are known, when we deliberated about pharmaceutical sponsorship of immunization coalition meetings, we invited members of the immunization coalition and the pharmaceutical companies to participate. So depending on what the issue is, we have many, many, and this time there's going to be a large number of ad hoc members who are engaged in the deliberation, because there are a lot of people who have a stake in this, or an opinion on this, I should say. I'm a little bit intimidated by thinking about how large this process is going to be, but I'm confident the technology and the breakout rooms will help us out.
Other questions or thoughts about the Free Fridge program? Okay, well, thank you for that update. I think we can move on now to the last item on our agenda, which is the nominations committee for a slate of officers for 2023. So for next year, we will need to nominate slate of officers, which is the chair, the vice chair, and a member at large. And Alan, maybe you could speak a little bit to the timeline of this, since I'm a little fuzzy on that, on those details.
Yeah, according to the FAC bylaws, and I have them here somewhere, we need to have a nominations committee convened by November 1st. And here they are. I know we need to have a committee convened by November 1st, and then we have to vote. FAC needs to vote on, so the committee has to be convened by November 1st, produce a slate of officers, and then they need to be voted on, and then put into office, you know, depending on the, you know, the election by the beginning of the year. So let me see if I can read the, okay. Here's section 3 of Article 6. A nominations committee will be formed from the council by November 1st of each year. Its purpose is to recommend to the full council a slate of council members to serve as the executive committee, which is the officers that Dr. Hedrick just mentioned. The executive committee will be selected by a vote of the council at the council's first meeting of the calendar year. So we got to have this committee in place by November 1st. They're going to produce a slate of officers, a nominated slate that will be voted on by all of you at the first meeting in 2023. And given that our next meeting is, I think, October 25th, that's pretty close to November 1st, we figured we'd put the call out there for a nominations committee so we can get this going and soliciting people who are interested in continuing on and moving up on the executive committee joining the executive committee, you know, get a slate for you to vote on in at the first meeting of 2023.
And if anyone's interested in serving as an officer on the committee, please email Mallory with your interest. And I believe for the nominations committee, we're looking for 3 members. 3 volunteers.
If anybody's interested, it's not a lot of work, because we'll handle all, you know, we'll solicit and help, organize our staff will help organize, people who submit their names and all that. But so it's not a huge amount of work. You can let us know later also, but we may start picking on people if we don't hear from you and asking you.
And Any questions about the nominations committee or the process for selecting the slate of officers?
One other thing, you can avoid becoming a nominee by volunteering to be on the nominating committee, if that helps. Sorry.
It looks like you have two people in the chat who have said yes.
Oh, good. I haven't
looked. Maybe one.
Elma, are you saying yes to being on the nominating committee, or?
It was about the free fridge.
Oh, okay.
But if you want me to volunteer, I'll volunteer. I just need some guidance.
Dave has very kindly volunteered.
But, it'd be nice to have one more, but we'll work with two if we have to.
I'll volunteer. How many hours again? Sorry.
I think it's going to be fairly minimal, Shona. Not more than an hour. I think we'll be, if we need to solicit names and get them to you. And then there's also people who are currently in position that may be moving up as well.
Yeah.
Hopefully they'll volunteer to do that. So,
I'll volunteer.
Right. Thank you.
Great. Thank you to all the volunteers, Dave and Elma and Shona.
Great.
Okay. Do we have any other member updates for today? Anyone have any anything they would like to update the council about, or other topics anyone wanted to talk about for today? I know we're a little ahead of schedule.
This is Maria, and I have a quick question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Just for planning purposes, are we having a December 27th meeting? That's the day after a holiday.
So our next meeting is October 25th, and then we've been meeting every 2 months. So we can pick, if folks are willing to do that, we can pick a different date in December, if you're all willing to do that.
I wonder if early December might be better.
Council Chair Bowerman, would that work for you? Because I know we moved to the 4th Tuesday, I believe. You're on mute. You're still on mute. There you go.
Did that do it?
Yes.
Oh, wow. I unmuted where it said Alan Melvick.
That says something right there.
You never know. Our December schedule is not put together yet, so I'm flexible at this point. Yeah.
So maybe we'll look if Tuesday night seems to work, we'll look at maybe the first or second Tuesday in December.
Okay. All right. Well, our next meeting is October 25th. I think with that, we've come to the end of another back meeting. So thank you all for joining us, for being so generous with your time on a Tuesday evening. So I'll looking forward to seeing everyone in October.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody. Thank you.
Thanks.